After Napoleon was victorious at the Battle of Marengo on 14 June 1800, Paul had decided to support France fully, further inciting resistance against him. General Count Peter Palin remained the sole member of the original conspiracy who was still in St. Petersburg, simply because he continued to serve as the city's governor and minister of secret police. All but Panin regrouped in Lithuania at the castle of Bialystok near the Russian border. The castle belonged to the niece of the ousted King Stanislaus of Poland. Armfelt described the verbal sparring involved in the planning. They were long-winded, unpleasant, and difficult to wrap up. They finally agreed that both Grand Dukes would have to be persuaded that their father, the Emperor, was unfit to rule and needed to be arrested and removed from power. His removal would be attributed to madness, one that might be healed with time and proper care. Alexander would be named regent in his father's stead and restore rule to his father when he was cured. In Paris, plots were simultaneously forming against Napoleon. Had Napoleon successfully been removed from power, Elizabeth Sparrow has suggested, Tsar Paul may have been spared himself. Without Napoleon, the international considerations of his rule would have been removed. Armfelt informed his king that if the plot was to be effective, it would need to be a successful propaganda operation in order to deceive those who were still loyal to Paul I, and who would wish to thwart any attempt to remove Tsar Paul from power. They would also need to operate in complete secrecy. At the same time, they needed to turn opinion against Paul by inflating pre-existing perceptions of his violent personality. This was accomplished by misinformation designed to make the Tsar suspicious of his sons as traitors. Then he was persuaded to consider imprisoning them, while other officials worried that they could share the same fate. Next, Tsar Paul had to be convinced to recall to St. Petersburg those whom he had banished to exile. Paul I's valet de chambre, Kutaisov, an ethnic Turkish slave given as a personal servant to Paul when he was just a child, Paul strongly trusted him, was almost entirely reliant on him. Kutaisov, it turned out, was not above bribery, and he had regularly received large sums of British Secret Service funds from Sir Charles Whitworth earlier during Paul's reign. On November 1, 1800, Palin persuaded Paul to pardon senior officers who were living in exile. Palin himself wrote the edicts for their return to St. Petersburg. Upon their return, they fawned over the Tsar to create an air of tranquility and reconciliation at the court. In his account, Armfelt plays down the role of royal French planners while emphasizing the role of the English. By mid-March 1801, all the preparations were made and all the players were in place. Prince Platon Zubov had charge of the actual coup, while Palin was in charge of the troops destined to preserve tranquility and public safety during the subsequent transition. Alas, in the last moments before the coup, Paul I was tipped off in an anonymous letter naming the conspirators and their evil intentions. The Tsar received the letter on March 20th. The next day, he confronted his sons and forced them to swear that they did not intend to take his life. The sons were able to do so honestly, for they had only agreed to force Paul's abdication, not to assassinate him. Paul likewise confronted Palin, who laughed off his sovereign's accusations. By then, Palin had complete control of military guards, police, and administration of St. Petersburg. Remarkably, Armfelt claims he dined with the Tsar and General Kutuzov, who was not a co-conspirator, on the final day of Tsar Paul's life. It is possible that he was there to ensure a calm atmosphere and report on Paul's behavior and frame of mind. Paul seemed to be aware of the attack planned for that evening. Armfelt then describes how Zubov, leader of 27 conspirators, entered the private apartments of the Tsar. They had already been let into the cellars to await the right moment to strike. The level of detail in his brief memoir suggests that Armfalt was himself one of those 27 British co-conspirators. The attack took place as planned at 1:30 a.m. early morning on 24 March. Next to Paul's bedroom, Palin had stationed over 100 palace guards, not to protect the Tsar from assassination, but in order to restrain the Empress if she made any attempt to stop the conspirators from carrying out the assassination. No one at the Russian court intervened to save Emperor Paul's life. Palin had no hand in what took place in the Tsar's chamber. The Tsar was skilled in swordplay, and Armfalt claimed that Paul actually overcome Platon Zubov's initial attack. Paul I nearly managed to kill Platon Zubov with his own sword until Nicholas Zubov knocked Paul's sword away. When the Empress appeared in the doorway, the conspirators felt rushed to complete their business. Platon Zubov, drunk and angry from his humiliation, took the Tsar's own sash and strangled Paul with his own hands, whispering, "Commend yourself to God and go there." The assassins then stomped on the corpse of the murdered Tsar to ensure that, in fact, he was dead. The next morning, the news of the conspiracy's success reached Stedingk, who became the first diplomat to know the events. He, in turn, wrote to the Swedish king 2 days later, on March 26th. He wrote that the news of Paul I's death created a barely decent public jubilation. For his service in the murder, Platon Zubov was restored to the emperor's council. Palin retained all of his positions and command of St. Petersburg, while temporarily gaining control of foreign affairs as well, until Nikita Panin returned from Moscow. Panin arrived in St. Petersburg on 27 or 28 March and reestablished a friendly relationship with Alexander, Paul's son, and the heir to the throne.